I'll read you another bit of... Taliesin's poems, actually, because he's all about identity. So this is Taliesin talking about who he is. He's explaining who he is in very mythological terms, right? But I'll explain it as we do. I am primary chief poet to Elfin, and my native country is the place of the summer stars. John the Divine called me Merlin, but all future kings shall call me Taliesin. I was 9 full months in the womb of the hag Caridwen. Before that I was Gwion, but now I am Taliesin. I was with my king in the heavens when Lucifer fell into the deepest hell. I carried the banner before Alexander. I know the names of the stars from the north to the south. I was in Caribedion, Tetragrammaton. I accompanied Haon to the Vale of Hebron. I was in the cannon when Absalom was slain. I was in Chishdon before the birth of Gwydion. I was patriarch to Elijah and Enoch. I was there at the crucifixion of the merciful Mammon. I was the foreman at the construction of Nimrod's tower. I was 3 times in the prison of Arianrod. I was in the ark with Noah and Alpha. I witnessed the destruction of Sodom and Gomorrah. I was in Africa before the building of Rome, and I came here to the remnant of Troy. I was with the Lord in the manger of the ass. I upheld Moses through the water of the Jordan. I was in the cross with the Mary Magdalene. I received the muse from Caridwen's cauldron. I was a harping bard to Dayon of Lochlin. I have gone hungry for the maiden's Mabon. I was in the White Mount in the court of Cunveilin, in stocks and fetters for a year and a day. I was in the larder and in the land of the Trinity, and no one knows whether my body is flesh or fish. I was instructor to the whole universe. I shall be until the judgment on the face of the earth. I have sat in the perilous seat above Sagkaivacidi. I shall continue to revolve between the 3 elements. There is not a marvel in the world I cannot reveal. So, mythological poem. But he also goes on to say, this is the thing I read earlier on. There's another one, actually. I have been a sow, I have been a buck, I have been a sage, I have been a snout, I have been a horn, I have been a wild sow, I have been a shout in battle, I have been a gushing torrent, I have been a wave on the long I have been a wave on the long shore. I have been a gentle rain, I have been a speckled cat in a forked tree, I have been a circle, I have been a head, I've been a goat in an elder tree, I've been a crane bag well filled, a sight to behold. And then another poem. What are you when you're sleeping? A body or a spirit or a being of life? Well, skillful minstrel, will you not answer? Do you not know where night awaits the day? Do you know how many leaves are on the bush? Do you know how the mountain was raised before the elements were settled? What supports the world? What makes it habitable? Oldest at his birth, human beings grow younger. Okay. Massively obscure, these poems, right? But in the first poem, what we have is him saying, is him really saying, I am the universe, right? So that ultimate kind of place, I am the universe. I am the teacher of the universe. I am the voice of inspiration that appears in particular forms. So identity for Taliesin is profoundly fluid. He is little Gwion. He is Taliesin. He can be like fire, he can be like water, he can be like a big tree, he can be like a goat's head, he can be anything, everything. But he is, whatever he is specifically there in that moment. The problem with for us of saying I can be the universe, of course you can be the universe, but then you have to be the universe. If you're going to say something like I am the universe, then you'd have to embody the whole universe. Now, mostly we can't do that, you'd blow up. But if I say, I am a shining sword, or I am yoga, if I am a shining sword, I embody the shining sword. If I am the cauldron of inspiration, I embody the cauldron of inspiration. I bring it through. Now, the other thing that Taliesin says about himself . This is Song of the Macrocosm. I praise my father, my God, my strength, who infused in my head both soul and reason. And these are the two parts of the mind, the soulful part of the mind, the reasonable part, the part that understands, the part that inspires. Who, to keep guard over me, did bestow my seven senses. It's an interesting phrase, my seven senses, from fire and earth, water and air, from mist and flowers, from the winds and the trees, much skillful wisdom my father has bestowed upon me. It goes on to say, the five senses are touching, one is for touching, two is for tasting, three is for seeing, four is for hearing, five is for smelling, six is for instinct, and seven is for speaking. Now he adds two senses, instinct and speaking. Now instinct is the place where the senses come together in that place of trust, that kind of mysterious something moving. Speaking is then the seventh sense. It is to be fully human, fully Taliesin, you bring together your senses, you trust the instinct, the deeper intuition, and then you speak from that place into the specific nature of thing and your identity. But you speak would speak as a shining sword, you might speak as a great wind, you might speak as a long wave. These are the forms that arise from that instinctual kind of place. When you get present in your senses, so you get present in your five senses, present to the inner and the outer. And then you're in touch with that place of intuition or instinct. And then the form of identity arises and you speak as that form. Now that's the complete difference from the kind of, so this is the old bardic way of embodying the kind of mystery. So that's the difference when I talked about the storytellers in the beginning today, who instead of letting their identity shift so they speak out of the deep place. So, you know, Bex, you'll be talking as the tree, as the new leaf, as the allowing that to come through your form of expression. What you don't do is you take the tree and you make a story about, you make Becky's story of the tree as Becky's cognitive story of the tree. Then you lose the connection with instinct and you don't speak out of the deep place. The storytellers take the stories and mash it into themselves. They don't open themselves to the deep images and let their identity become replaced by the image that's trying to speak. And in a way, that's the whole, it takes us back to, I'll talk tomorrow a bit, because we don't have so much time now, about the whole tradition of the Druids and where that comes from. But the idea of the Druid, if you think of if we look at what we know about Druids, one of the great images you get about Druids is they will walk on the battlefield and they bring peace. So they stand between the warring parties. Now, for Druids to bring peace in that place, they have to, genuine peace as opposed to just a suppressed peace, they have to be present to the place of peace inside them and to the war outside them, and to find a meeting point in that. And so they have to speak the words of counsel or judgment that come from that place, are the place that will integrate the two opposite viewpoints, the two warring viewpoints. So you have this very profound thing with the images of Druids, where they can, they step into the warring places and they create something new, a living peace. They multiply the possibilities of life in that place. And that depends really on being able to let your identity be fluid and not fixed. Now, our problem for most of us is that we have different degrees of fluidity and fixity in our nature. You know, judge, you know, that's what our life does to us. You discover who you are by reflection, by the experiences of your life. And and if you're very fortunate in your life, you have a lot of flexibility in yourself. You can relax, because the key thing to this fluidity and flexibility is the capacity to trust. To trust, you have to relax. Now, if your life has been very difficult and you've been under a lot of attack, it's very hard to do that. You know, so what you generally do is find you can trust in particular circumstances that you recognize. And that's where we come back to the business of retreat centers, where actually, so the reason retreat centers work is they create a very safe holding space so people can relax. They create a controlled world. Now, that's brilliant when people are disturbed and people need sanctuary. But when that relaxation then becomes dependent upon those particular conditions being created, then the process of addiction to those conditions starts to kick in, because I can only be this person when I have these particular outer conditions around me. Rather than the more alchemical position that says, I am at peace deeply with myself. Even the bits of me I dislike. We're not called to like those places, right? We're called on to trust even our dislike. Right? We're called upon to transform ourselves into better people. We learn to be more trusting people, trusting even of the things that we consider to be negative, if they come to us in that instinctual, present kind of way. So to trust the place of me that looks at me and think, Christ, you look fatty. You know, think, God. You know, so there's something about that, not even pushing that away, letting myself be with that, letting myself be with the self-critical voice, listening to that, and rather than pushing that away, me like, no, I'm not. It's very difficult. It's very, very hard. Easiest thing in the world for me to say, but actually, of course, I can't do it. You know, I work with it. So it's something you work with, not something you can do, but something you just let yourself notice. So if anything, about the first step is to observe, is to see. So watch yourself doing it, watch your reactions, watch your acting out, and just think, okay, just keep coming back to it, keep coming back to it. And underneath the very elaborate and poetic language, that's what Taliesin is talking about. This capacity to be present with the deep place with Anuvin, and to listen to the movement, the instinct is the movement of the Awen. It's that breath of inspiration taking form, shaping itself towards the conditions, internal and external, that are going on. And then speaking that, bringing yourself into active, dynamic relationship. You know, if you're a bard, you speak the poem, or if you're a therapist, you say the thing that reframes people's experience, or you just listen and receive their experience, depending whatever the need is. You challenge the Westminster Pastoral Foundation without getting stuck in that, or whatever, you know, whatever is the need, whatever is the energy. You tell Terry to bugger off or something, I don't know, you know, it's that energy, right? So it happens in whatever circumstance, and can we trust ourselves first of all to receive our experience and then to act and speak it. So the act of speaking here is very, very important. It's not a silent process, it comes out of silence, but then it comes into activity. and needs to. And it's that process, that it's that whole process then, that, which is the alchemy. You know, it's a sort of, you know, and in terms of what we're doing here, this business of the body of flesh and the body of the dream, which ultimately, as they come together, forms this mysterious body where something happens out of nowhere. But we embody it, we completely be it. You know, so if you're going to speak as the tree of new leaf, in that moment you are fully the tree of new leaf, trusting it. You have to trust that and let it speak through you. Or if you're sitting with your client and you're receiving, you know, you're receiving an impression of needing to speak or to hold something up, you do that. And in a way, the more we do that, the more fluid we become. And it's this strange combination of fluidity and density, because we don't become fluffy. Actually, what happens is, as we do, out of this fluidity, we become more sharp-edged, more direct, perhaps, and more clear. So this is the paradox, right, of from the unknowing, from the cooperation with this fluid process, you actually become more definite, more defined, but less fixed. Fixity and rigidity is our habitual defensive process that we've built up to keep ourselves safe. Now what happens, the more we engage with this process, that the need for defense, as Reagan said earlier on, is really important. But it is the awareness itself that becomes the defense, not the automatic defense, not the automatic image of ourselves, the protective armor. So what happens is the armor starts to dissolve, so there is a feeling of vulnerability, but there is this sharp-edged clarity that then becomes the energy that protects. And again, the true protection really is in trusting that and going with it. Now, the bards, the image that the bards had about enlightenment, which is, you know, so in Buddhism you've got this idea of enlightenment and the Buddha becoming free of everything. Now, the image that you get from the Welsh traditions is actually almost the opposite. It's the same thing really, I think, but it's an opposite posture where it says you become everything. You become into relation, you don't leave the world, you enter fully into the world. So your capacity, so you have the capacity to be very deeply with everything you come across. But you are always more than whatever conditions you are. So in that little process that we did with the mirrors and sort of, so we and the meditation, so we travel, so we experience the inside of ourselves, we experience the outside, and we experience the universal part of ourselves. Now all these are one thing, one fluid moving process. And the deep trust, in a way, is to keep trusting the universal within the particular. So the particular is just us, right? This is Ian, Maria, Fern, Reagan, Bex, Sue, Penny, right? So we are the particular expressions of the universal in this room, expressing the universal through every thought, every movement, every feeling. And the more conscious we can be of that, the more aware we are of that, the more we relax. Because the less isolated we feel, and in an odd way, in that fluidity we become sharper, more defined, safer, more open as well. So it's a real, again, opposites coming together kind of feeling. And so what you find happening in the bardic literature all the time is when they talk about enlightenment, there are these huge orations. That's a Taliesin. Let's see if I can find one. There's a song about McGinn in here somewhere. This will be an Irish version if I can find it. Yeah. Yeah, so this is from the Irish tradition, Irish bardic tradition, and it's about the invasions of Ireland. Amagen Whiteneath, son of Mill, set his right foot upon Ireland and sang. I am a wave on the sea, I am a wave of the ocean, I am the roar of the sea. I am an ox of seven exiles, I am a hawk on a cliff, I am the tear of the sun, I am a turning in a maze, I am a boar in valour, I am a salmon in a pool, I am a lake on a plain, I am a dispensing power, I am a spirit of skillful gift, I am a grass blade giving decay to the earth, I am a creative God giving inspiration. Who else clears the mountain, the stones of the mountain? Who is it who declaims the sun's arising? Who is it who tells where the sun sets? Who brings cattle from the house of Tethera? Upon whom do the cattle of Tethera smile? Who is this ox? Who is this weaving god who mends the thatch of wounds? The incantation of the spear, the incantation of the wind. And he also uttered the spell to bespell fish into the islets. Fishful the sea, fruitful the land, a fountain of fish, fish and a wave like a torrent of birds, a crowded sea, a white hail of countless salmons, of broad-mouthed whales, a harbour spell, a fountain of fish, a fishful sea. It's beautiful. And he takes on himself, Penny's locked us over. You log as ever. So Amagen takes on himself all these kind of. I'll read it again actually, because probably because Penn's doing Ireland, and I'll just read. I'll read you the song of Amagen. It's worth reading again.
Thank you.
So Amagen's song. I am a wind on the sea. I am a wave of the ocean. I am a roar of the sea. I am an ox of seven exiles. I am a hawk on a cliff. I am a tear of the sun. I am a turning in a maze. I am a boar in valour. I am a salmon in a pool. I am a lake on a plain. I am a dispensing power. I am a spirit of skillful gift. I am a grass blade giving decay to the earth. I am a creative God giving inspiration. Who else clears the stones of the mountain? Who is it who declaims the sun's arising? Who is it who tells where the sun sets? Who brings castle from the house of Tethera? Upon whom do the cattle of Tethera smile? Who is this ox? Who is the weaving god who mends the thatch of wounds, the incantation of a spear, the incantation of the wind? And he uttered a spell to dispel fish into the inlets. Fishful the sea, fruitful the land, a fountain of fish. Fish and a wave like a torrent of birds, a crowded sea. A white hail of countless salmon, of broad-mouthed whales, a harbour spell, a fountain of fish, a fishful sea. Now he's speaking there again from this place of deep identity, right? So not separate from anything. So this is, if you like, the image of enlightenment that you find in the Welsh and Irish text. Very like Walt Whitman, Song of Myself, completely. Walt Whitman completely does this. So he's a contemporary version of in his Song of Myself. He says, "I am everything," but it's the specific. We can all say, "I am everything," and it doesn't mean anything. In order for Amagen or for Walt Whitman or for Taliesin to say these things, he has to, in that moment, embody, to let his identity be subsumed in the image of the fruitful fish, or the healing god, or the dispensing power. And then when that happens, that experience is a felt experience that comes into the room and embodies in the room and then becomes tangible and present and creates the alchemy. When you're doing that, then you're working with the seven senses, not just the five. So what the five senses give you is the experience of embodiment, the experience of the body as the cauldron of new life. But then you have to, as you bring the senses together, that sixth sense, which is the sort of instinct, which is the intuition, which is the kind of, if like that, the place where you have to relax into the senses, into your experience, into the unknown nature of the cauldron, you trust, and then the energy emerges, the forms of identity, not just your identity, but the entity of the universe with you in it. That's the act of creation. That's the act of something coming together, and that's the act of alchemy, where what you bring into creation, what you bring through you, meets whatever is there. And it can be met with resistance, it can be met with love, it can be met with all kinds of things. But that's the moment where you, the edge that you have to sustain yourself on, which if you can keep connected to the deep sense of Anavan, the deep sense of the universe, then you can hold yourself in that place and allow the alchemy, because actually the speaking, the first speaking is easy. What then happens is there is a meeting. There is opposition, normally, to something new emerging. And then you have to find the way and make peace with between the energy arising in you and the energy that meets you. Now that can be an energy arising in yourself that meets you. It doesn't have to travel from the outside world. It can be your own resistance to your own intuition. Very often is. That's normally the first point of meeting. Then the second point of meeting is what happens when you, when people speak back at you. And the actual process of doing it is like this glyph, where you keep on working at it, round and round, but simultaneously there's this energy cutting through all the time. So that spine energy, that sort of stone energy that's right at the center, keeps cutting through all the time, but all the time we have to keep working with the complexity of the labyrinth. Amagen says, I am a turn in the labyrinth at one point, you know. Now the usefulness of some of these poems, once you understand what they're talking about, and they get that they're not talking about mythological archetypal memories, they're talking about something much more intimate and immediate, is that these are poems or stories left behind by people who understand that process and were brought up in a society where that understanding of that process was much more common. So this is sort of part of the world that we've left behind us. There's a wonderful book written by an American academic called Divine Luria, who called The World We Used to Know. And he's a Native American writer from near Seattle. And he talks about the worldview of the Native American tribes in the days before full colonization, in a sense. And he's talking about the things, these ways of understanding the intuition, the creative, the ways of bringing balance into the world that used to exist. And so, in a way, that's the reason why we need to sometimes to lean back into these older traditions, not because they're essential in themselves, but because they remind us something like the Song of Amagen, or something like Taliesin's poems. Says to us that place of fluidity. So when I ask myself that question, when you look in the mirror and ask yourself that question, I'm just listening to all of you really when you're doing it, what you're experiencing is a lot of fluidity. I am this, and then I'm that, and then I'm this. You're experiencing actually the same thing that Taliesin talks about in the story. Because actually what you discover, that your identity is not fixed, it is a continually moving. When you really pay attention and ask the question, you find there are lots of different shapes that keep emerging. And as you persist in it, you actually come to deeper and deeper shapes. Shapes that actually have that more elemental kind of character and are more powerful. And sometimes what you find in that are mysterious things, riddles that have to be solved, like I am my father's daughter. You know, that's not simple, really. That's part of something, an emerging mystery that's been happening over some months now. And so that coming back when we do that exercise today is not a simple thing. It's a conundrum, genuine conundrum, which needs just sitting with and thinking about and seeing what emerges out of that.
And it'd be easy, wouldn't it, which is why I think a lot of people are kind of doing the mindfulness malarkey now, because I think it's people are desperate to have the solution or the process that they can go and join that will give them the bridge, that will give them...
Give them the identity.
And I think the challenge is not to do it.
Totally. Totally. The problem with all that stuff is I am a mindfulness practitioner, right? So I then become limited by that. I become, when I join up and I do the courses, same thing as a retreat there. You know, I have a refresher course. This is what I do. People ask you that, what do you do? I do this. I cut myself down into a fitter template. And that's the danger of these forms. When actually our identity is all the time shifting and needs to shift in response to whatever circumstances that we're in.
And so can we allow other people that? I mean, first thing you say to at a party or something, you know, what do you do?
Yeah.
First thing you want to do is put someone else in a pigeonhole, isn't it?
Yeah.
Because one must have some sort of some point of contact with one. Personally, I've always thought ideas were better. So if you give someone an interesting question that interests you, and they answer it in a way that pleases you, and then you respond, then they're sort of fellow feeling rather than finding out that they're a stockbroker or whatever.
Yeah, I think that could be quite a skillful thing to do, because the problem with that question, what do you do, is one, it is generally actually quite a boring question, really, and but it's an easy question, which is why people always ask it. But so either nothing, you know, somebody says something and you all nod and nothing happens, or the other thing that happens is you come across somebody who loves talking about what they do, and then half an hour later, and you're trying to back out the door, you've still got this person that, you know, trying to tell you about something else is riveting about the job that they do. Oh no! Oh God, I know. Yeah. Or they do the jokey thing. It's sort of, ho ho ho! Don't analyse me, as if it, you know, as if it's the first fucking time you've heard this, rather than 19,000th time you've heard it.
Ho ho ho! Have you sacrificed any virgins yet?
Yes, that's right. Yeah, the Jewish thing. Yeah, definitely.
There must be a series. There must be a way of getting to understand whether you're going to like people. You know, have fellow feeling with people who are strangers.
Well, I think you notice that in the body very often. I think it's gut instinct. I think your body generally reacts to people quicker than your mind, actually. But it's staying attentive to that, I think, is the king. Because actually, people's energies you get long before they say much, really. You just get a feeling in the body. And I have to watch my wrath these days, because I tend to kind of dismiss people too. My particular problem is I tend to dislike people too quickly. And then I have to like them afterwards, really, because actually I've kind of somehow got past the irritating thing, and then I decide I like them again.
Which the best? It wasn't a put down, but I was at the party talking to this guy who was a dentist.
Yep.
This woman came and joined us. And he said to her, what do you do? She said, I'm in the medical profession. He said, yes, so am I. He said, I deal with teeth. What do you deal with? She said, at the other end of the body. He said, oh, what do you mean? She said, I'm a venereologist. It cut the conversation dead. He didn't say another word and he went off.
It's a bit hard to follow that, wasn't it? Oh, excellent. Oh, that must be interesting.
That existed, that job, venereologist.
It was fantastic. I said, well done. I said, try and get rid of him.
Wait,
I said, you should have asked if
he'd had the pox. Yes,
you
should
have recognised your face.
Yes, that's right.
I always like kind of Ramdas's approach. He always used to say, I'll believe who you think you are. If you believe who I think I am, we'll get on fine.
Fine, that's right. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah.
That was kind of nice.
No, that's after quite nice. I think that's the thing. You have to have a conversation. That's the thing about the thing you do get a lot actually in the Welsh and Irish traditions is this idea of conversation, colloquy they call it. Mm. So you get the conversation of the two sages, which we've looked at an earlier point with this. So that the idea is that conversation is very important. Mm. So it isn't find it in actually the Sufi tradition as well, very strongly. The Sufis have this idea called sohbet, which is the conversation which opens the heart. And again, actually, Sufi tradition is interesting because it's another tradition that is very much worked out in a non-monastic way. I mean, there are some monastic versions of Sufism, but mostly it's people living in the world, working out their spirituality in everyday life. Yeah, she begins to a Sufi group in the States, doesn't she? Yeah, yeah, that's right. Yeah. But so this idea of colloquy or conversation, and is that, of course, that movement back and forth between inside and outside. Mm. And, you know, when you get something like the colloquy of the two sages, they're talking about these very profound matters and just bringing and doing this thing where they bring their understanding, and then the other person brings their understanding, and kind of and the two understandings deepen because of the in a way the friction of the relationship. They're sort of pushing each other into deeper and deeper places in the conversation.
There's a big difference between judging someone with your head when you meet them and feeling something in your gut when you meet them. Mm. They're very different, aren't they?
I think they're two very different places, yeah. I mean, I think that's right. You know, and sometimes...
Because most people have never if you listen to your head. Most people are never what your head might tell you they might be.
No, I think that's absolutely right. Yeah. No, I think you have to listen deeper down. I think you're right. You know, kind of. If I listen to my head, I'd never make any friends. I'd hate everybody. Because I'm so swift to judge. I'm so swift to judge people. It's not true.
Yeah. So I find really interesting though, people's expectations of you. If you look, you know, I mean, well, this is a really parochial little town, you know, and I'm sort of, I look pretty normal, and I look a certain age, and I look and I go to different places. Suddenly, you're with people who think that you're in their gang.
Yeah.
In the edge of their gang. And their gang might be quite bigoted, or it might be part of the sort of, you know, political mafia that runs the place, or it might be anti. Oh, suddenly, you know, you're having a nice conversation, and then someone talks about the pink mafia, and you think,
gay
people. And obviously, they've made an expectation that you're in the gang, and you think, and it's presumably just because you're vaguely normal and the right age. And I find that the older I get, the more I have that happen to me.
Yes, you're quite deceptive looking for that project, because nobody would think, I don't imagine they think of you as a druid in Wales, and you don't look druidic, because you don't dress up in a druidic, you know, generally, in your robes, you don't dress in a druidic manner.
No.
So that's quite fun, really.
But I just think, you know, that people go to Wales because they are of a certain fixed temperament, you know, they want to keep people town, and they're happy with things the way they are.
You mean it's as bad as Glastonbury?
Completely different. It's the same thing. I look like a Glastonbury bloke, right? Because I've got the ponytail, I've got the beard, I find the opposite. I find the same thing actually. The people in Glastonbury make assumptions about things I believe or I'm in agreement with, and they think I'm a hippie. And then they discover I've got strong views and I'm not at all a hippie, you know. I've got a very strong work ethic. It's sort of chatting with a friend about it who keeps the my memory's going as I get older. Shit, I hate this. What's his name? What's the name of the bloke who looks after the place here? The old boy. Ken. Got it. So chatting with Ken, because I'm always here really early. You know, because I work. Sometimes I work at 8 o'clock in the morning, because I like that, I like getting up and working early, always have. And Glastonbury, 8 o'clock in the morning, particularly on a weekday, is a total fucking ghost town. I was here at 8:30 today getting things ready. So I bumped into Ken and said, you know, Ken, sometimes I think you and I are the only people that are awake in Glastonbury this time in the morning, because actually it's a total, like I drive into town, he's the only person I ever see till about 10:30, you know, and I think that's what happens. People look at us from the outside and they create an image of who they think they're, judging on whatever cues. I've got very particular cues, you've got particular cues, and sort of course, you're completely right that the inside of people is quite mysterious. And actually the real thing, the really interesting thing about people is that everybody has this connection to the universal. So everybody is much more than they think they are, and we are much more than we think we are. And of course that's the place that we're kind of working on. That's the edge that we're working on all the time. This edge of the unknown, where you if you work like this, you're continually pushing the edge of the envelope, where you're finding, and as you do that, you're always somewhere. So you're always having to deal with the next edge, the next bit of the unknown that's coming towards you. And the choice point all the time is whether you can let yourself stay in that place and let that alchemizing process to take you another step forward, or whether you decide, that's it, I've done enough, I'm just locking down now, and that's what I'm going to stay in this shape. And what you find, and particularly, you know, now being so old, What's interesting, actually, as you do get older, taking away the jokey bit of that comment, is that people do shut down at different phases. They just thought, I've done enough. And they, can you see them closing themselves down and thinking, bloody hell, that's kind of... And I've just watched so many people do this now over the years, that I've done my work and I'm quite... This is who I am. And they lose that fluidity of identity. And it's a horrible thing to see, because people kind of... Well, I just shut off. They became. I mean, Alion had a really powerful example of this on holiday. We had this. Most of the places we went to in Crete were lovely. We did this thing: never do, never, never do this. Never go back to a place you've been 30 years before and haven't been since. And I knew it was a risky thing to do, but I thought. We looked it up on the net. It looked very similar to how it used to be. Of course, it was totally different. But it was actually. It's a place called Matala, which is a kind of the hippie beach place of. And when we went there 30 years ago, it was just very, very quiet, very beautiful, very quite primitive, but quite a nice place. It's now become marketed as the hippie place in Crete, and it's hippified. The whole fucking place is hippified. You have mock hippie drawings on the wall. Oh, it's horrible. But really bizarrely, we ended up by pure accident. We thought we booked what we thought was the most comfortable hotel in Matala. They didn't have a very good range of hotels. But we were, the internet lied to us, and we ended up in this really grim little place. But that bizarrely turned out to be the place that we'd stayed in 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. Except it put up its prices by a factor of 10, which is why we thought it was probably going to be a bit plusher than it was. And we had this real weird, really weird, because we didn't do this intentionally, sort of crossing over of worlds, of our younger selves, and even remembering the room that we'd been in. And there was a woman who was running the place, and we remember quite a young woman who was there, around about our age, and who was with a young kid who was just starting out, and so there was this old, what we thought of an older woman, and a really old mother were running the place. And we assumed that the woman who was running the place, who looked not too, a bit younger than us, but not too much younger, we thought, was the person that we knew who was running the place 30 years ago. When actually the person who was running the place 30 years ago was the ancient old mother, who had been this sparky young woman, but was a totally shut off kind of, you know, and she could only be 60 something. And was this like little old granny in the corner who barely string two words together. And the woman who we thought was contemporary with us was about 30 years younger than us. And there's something about, you know, I'm not judging them at all, but there's something about the place where you could see that the shapes that these people had taken. Now, they were living very, it wasn't like poverty or anything. This wasn't grinding poverty, because poverty can make people look very old. These are people who have lived, run this successful hotel, really successful hotel, and earning a huge amount of money from it. And yet, somewhere, the capacity to grow or to develop has stopped. And so these people, both mother and daughter, kind of were much older to my eyes than many people I come across. And people do this, I think. You have this choice of do you continue to open? And if you do open, the thing that this intrigue, this interesting line in Taliesin's poem here, where he asks us who we are. You know. What are you in sleeping, a body or a spirit or a being of light? O skillful minstrel, will you not answer? Do you know when night awaits the day? Do you know how many leaves there are on the bush? How the mountain was raised before the elements were settled? What supports the world? What makes it habitable? Oldest at its birth, human being grows younger. Now the human being grows younger by continuing to be able to ask those questions. Why? Why does that happen? It's Alice asking those questions, the curiosity of Alice that takes her into new worlds. So the age is actually then a function, or being old or young. It's not a function of the body, it's a function of whether our capacity to be open and become curious. And to become, if we are open to the question and the answer that arises in us, we are open to the youngest thing that happens in the universe, because that thing is born in that moment. And if we embody that, we embody the youngest thing in the universe, however old our bodies, that greenness, that freshness of life, is because we are embodying the youngest thing in the universe just in that moment. And it's why it's sometimes when you look at very old people in their 80s, I'll probably be saying very old people in their 90s shortly, actually, because it's kids. 80s, I'm just about all right with 80s, because I'm still sort of only 61 now. I'm thinking that's 20 years in advance. When I go, exactly, once I hit 70, I'll be talking in my 90s, if I'm still here. old will be 90s, because you keep moving it on. And yes, if you're in your 40s, so you were being old, good, you wait. it'll go, age is something you put, it moves ahead of you. But you see, the thing is, when you do hit, we see people who are generally quite old, that generally there's two types of people. There are very youthful old people, and they're very old people. And the difference, I think, is in that decision-making, that ability to be curious, be open, be kind of new again. That's the great gift of this work. As you continue to do that, you are made new. It's that phrase, Jesus' phrase, "Behold, I make all things new." Actually, the other person who does this identity thing, you find it in the Bible, is Jesus. He says things about himself like, "I am the true vine, I am the Lamb of God, I am the light of the world." He's again speaking out of the same place, exactly the same place that Taliesin and Amagen is speaking. He's saying the same sort of thing, "Let your light shine." Speak, express the, in the Gospel of Thomas, he says, if you do not bring forth that which is within you will destroy you. So if you hold it in, if you separate yourself, you end up blocked and stopped. If you let things flow as they've intended to flow, you will continually be made new, continually be recreated. Your body will do the things that bodies do. They will. Eventually you'll get old and you'll die. I mean, that's what happens to all of us. It's unavoidable, but you can die and be young. Youth is not dependent on your body. It's dependent upon your relationship to the deep place of Anuvin within you and the rising life of the Awen.
Are you trying to teach cheat or getting old here?
No, because what happens is your body gets old, and you have to deal with that. That's inevitable. The youthful energy in you has to meet the age in your body. The fact is, I have to meet the fact that my bloody knee aches after I sit for a certain while, and my back, and I got a bit of sciatica, and my fucking heart's doing something I don't want it to do apparently. And so I'll have to take rat poison, so I'm going to start taking rat poison. So you have to adapt, that's unavoidable. So you could, now the danger is you could just deny that, because people do, and sometimes people use these kind of traditions to completely avoid that. And you find these sort of people who don't embody their age. If you have to be present with part of letting this green energy through your body, is that energy then has to meet the older energy in you, the fact that your body can't do all the things it used to. The fact that you are now quite careful about getting up and down, because you can't quite do it in the same old way, so no, it isn't about denying anything, it's actually about embracing everything, even the experience of age. So there it brings the energy, the greenness of youth, together with the experience of an older body. And that's the place that you have to make peace with, where that becomes the peacemaking place.
You just put a million plastic surgeons out of
Oh, I know, isn't it? It's a hellish thing. It's so weird. Plastic, God, how plastic
so
surgery.
And
it just doesn't work. It looks so artificial. It's just sort of awful.
When you see people who have spent tens of thousands because they're rich, you see what a mess they've made of themselves.
I know.
What chances there are maybe by 500, but
I know.
The tragedy now is that it's young people having all this treatment, girls and their
children. Oh, I know.
That's
obscene. That's a horrible thing.
But what I noticed when I was younger, and I think it's a gender thing, and I think it's a generational thing, and I think it's gone now, my parents, they didn't get divorced. It was not the norm.
Yep.
And I noticed that my mum and after mum particularly, I thought, you just stopped thinking on your wedding day. Because getting married was